you say in the book that it was a 4-hour journey from London to Stratford, and it takes about the same amount of time now. Why is that? Why is it way more complicated than it should be to get from London to Stratford on the train?
That's a good question. You would think with the history of tourism, there would be at least a twice daily express train.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 905, Visiting Shakespeare's House. Richard Shook has written Shakespeare's House, A Window onto His Life and Legacy, a wonderful new biography about not only the building William Shakespeare was born in Stratford-upon-Avon, but how that building survived and became ground zero in the Shakespeare tourism industry. The word legacy is perhaps the most important word in the title Shakespeare's House, A Window onto His Life and Legacy, as Richard explained to me how his book acquired a sort of dual focus.
The central question of the book is, how did an ordinary family house in an ordinary English town become, over a few centuries, the global center of the Shakespeare cult? And just to get all professorial for a second,
please.
There are only two book-length studies of Shakespeare's birthplace, and the last one was written in the 1880s. So I thought it was time.
Oh my goodness. I assumed there were more, and in fact, I assumed that the book would be a little, frankly, dry, and it is so not. There's maybe a couple of paragraphs more about Wattle and Daub than I strictly cared about, but it is surprisingly page-turning, because as you talk about, yes, there is a mystery involved too. It's the house where he was born, but why did it survive? How did it survive? And as you say, how did it become the centerpiece of Shakespeare bardolatry?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because in a sense, the book does have two faces. It's, the house when Shakespeare lived there, and then sort of the house as Shakespeare's afterlife, and how it became a sort of shrine and monument. And readers kind of go one way or the other. Either they are really all about the Wattle and Daub, and they want to know how many rooms and who did what was the furniture like, and what were the pillows like. And that's very exciting, because all of that, is a discourse, if you will, about family life and social values. Or, like you, readers like, okay, Shakespeare grew up in that house, but the really interesting story is what happened to it over the centuries, and who owned it, and who lived there. When did the first tourists start to come, and when did P.T. Barnum almost end up buying it, and how was it rescued for the nation, and how was it preserved, and what were the fights over that? And that story, how the birthplace became the birthplace, seems to mirror perfectly changing cultural perceptions of Shakespeare. How we think about Shakespeare and how people treated the house, those concepts or expectations move in lockstep over four centuries.
And it really took about two centuries for people to start appreciating Shakespeare and turning him into the sort of brand that we're aware of now, yeah?
That's right, because, so there's a little bit of theater history. So Shakespeare died in 1616. The Puritans closed the theaters in 1642. But even before 1642, theater was kind of on the decline in London. And then theaters were closed more or less for 18 years till 1660, when the restoration of the monarchy under Charles II, the theaters were reopened. And of course, there weren't really any new plays, so they had to go back And of course, you know, Shakespeare was one of the big three, Johnson, Shakespeare, and Beaumont and Fletcher writing together. But Shakespeare was not so popular. He was the least popular of the three, and there was no biographical interest at all. So the idea that Shakespeare becomes sort of the summit of English drama and the paragon of English cultural supremacy really takes about a century and a half, as you said, and it's David Garrick in the middle of the 17th century with his Jubilee in 1769 and playing lead roles in London, that Shakespeare and the additions of Shakespeare all throughout the 18th century. So all of these kind of forces are sort of converging upon each other. And it's really the mid to the late 18th century that Shakespeare becomes Shakespeare as we know him today, and not one of a lot of playwrights writing in the Elizabethan and Jacobean period. So when Shakespeare acquires this cultural status or cultural authority, people become more curious about his life. Well, you know, how did England produce this sort of freak genius of dramatic arts and of poetry? And where did he live? And did the place where he lived, the house where he lived, have anything to do with how he became the cultural titan that he was? So the first tourists start to come really in the middle of the 18th century, when interestingly, Shakespeare's descendants through his sister Joan Hart own the house and were living in it.
Yeah.
So the first tourists who, David Garrick and Charles Macklin, great actors from the middle of the 18th century, among them, they were introduced to the house by a descendant of Shakespeare.
Which is amazing that they still were around. And in the house.
And in the house. And so, of course, it wasn't William Shakespeare's house. It was his father's house.
Right.
And John Shakespeare died in 1601. So William, as the eldest son, inherited it, but never lived there. I mean, when he left, when he got married at 18 or whenever, we don't really know. But at some point, he left. But when he inherited the house upon his father's death, he was already living in a new place, a much bigger house in Stratford, and of course, most of the time in London. So he didn't live there, but he owned it. And when he died in 1616, it went to his daughter, Susanna Hall. She died in 1649. It went to her daughter, Elizabeth Barnard, who died around 1670. And Elizabeth Barnard was Shakespeare's granddaughter, was the last direct descendant of Shakespeare to own the birthplace, although she didn't live there either.
Yeah.
Because all this time, Shakespeare was letting his sister, Joan Hart, and her children live there because they had tough times and never really had very much money, and he charged them a peppercorn rent. And eventually, when Elizabeth Barnard died in 1670, she gave the house to her cousin Thomas Hart, like Joan Hart's grandson. And then the Harts owned it till about 1805. But you think all the way from Shakespeare's lifetime to 1805, the house was owned by the family and lived in by the family, which is a very long time.
I'm Peter Holland. I'm the McNeill Family Professor in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? We'll be performing The Complete History of Comedy Abridged this weekend at the American Theater in Hampton, Virginia on April 12th and the Hilton Performing Arts Center in Fairfax, Virginia on April 13th, 2024. Check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Richard Shook. I asked him why his book Shakespeare's House, A Window Onto His Life and Legacy, has been wonderfully called sparklingly irreverent.
I'm mostly irreverent about the shenanigans and tricks played by people when they depicted the house and when they restored it. So, for example, there's a famous drawing by Richard Greene that was published in a lot of magazines in 1769 in the run-up to Garrick's Jubilee. It's a drawing of the birthplace. It's the first public illustration of the birthplace. And it is completely fictitious.
Yeah.
It makes the birthplace huge. It cleans up the frontage, ignores the fact that part of it was an inn and part of it was a butcher shop. And somehow all the other houses on Henley Street have disappeared. And it becomes a sort of picturesque monument that if you then went to Stratford and looked at the house, you'd say, the house looks nothing like this beautiful picture. The house is a dump. But it gets worse. So that was the 1760s. A century later, after the house was saved for the nation and what is now known as the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust was founded, the big question was, well, what do we do with the house? And the trustees decided they were going to restore it. That is, to make it look like it was in Shakespeare's time. Well, nobody knows what it looked like in Shakespeare's time because there are no records, let alone pictures. So what did they do? They went back to this totally fanciful, imaginary 1769 drawing and restored the house, although the restores is the wrong word, remade the house.
Yeah.
So it looks like this drawing. So in other words, the house was restored or remade to look like the house that Shakespeare, the genius Shakespeare, should have been born in, but wasn't.
Right.
So the house isn't addressing a truth about Shakespeare. It's addressing a truth about us, how we think about Shakespeare. We think Shakespeare deserves this grand house. He wasn't actually born in a grand house. He was born in an ordinary house. But, you know, doggone it, he's William Shakespeare, and he deserves to have been born in a landmark.
Right.
And that's what you see today in Stratford. So, and it looked, of course, the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust is very, very upfront about this. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But this is why I find the history fascinating. There are all these little, as I say, tricks and shenanigans and shortcuts. And underneath it all is the truth that we're not really searching for Shakespeare himself. We are searching for our idea of Shakespeare. And that idea always changes.
Yes. You know, memorials and funerals are not for the dead people. They're for the people living and remembering. The same way with Shakespeare's house. It's not about the man. It's about us in the place where he lived. That connection between that, us trying to find that connection between ourselves and the great man.
I think it was William Winter who said, you know, the most important person in the birthplace is the visitor, not Shakespeare himself. And, you know, I looked at a lot of photographs of the birthplace of the 19th century, and a lot of them are reproduced in the book. And what really struck me was the aura, the atmosphere, the sort of the vibe, if you will, that is no longer there, because the house, in a sense now, looks like, you know, there's furniture and wax apples and all the sort of things. It sort of looks like a family home. But in the 19th century, it really did have this sort of minimalist museum feel, where in any room, there were only one or two objects, a bust of Shakespeare, the signatures on the walls or etched into the glass, a few rickety chairs pushed up against the wall, and all this open space for you.
Mm.
For you to commune with Shakespeare, find Shakespeare, put yourself in the space, have some kind of an encounter. I think today it's an interesting experience, but it's a very passive one. We are sort of consuming a kind of a decorated version of history. But what I love about the 19th century, which is they are very honest, which is, you know, Shakespeare said, you know, 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings. Well, 'tis your thoughts. That from the prologue to Henry V, the 19th century really understood that. It's the visitor's thoughts that animate the space and make it enchanted. And that's why I really wanted to tell this story, because I think most people don't know it.
Presentation matters too. To use a real estate term, your book has fantastic curb appeal. It's, you know, it's handsome looking. I love the cover that looks like a blueprint for a house, but it's in green. So there's a natural feel to it. Did you have any say in the design of the book?
First of all, credit to Arden Shakespeare and Bloomsbury for magnificently producing this book. They were enthusiastic about this book from the start, and as you say, it shows in the presentation. I love the cover, the kind of quirky, you know, grand plan of a house shown from different angles. I can take zero credit for that. It was their idea, but when I saw it, it was love at first sight. The only thing I can take credit for, apart from the text, is the title. Everything else is the Arden Shakespeare, and they did a wonderful job.
Well, and I think you said in your acknowledgments they believed that this could reach a readership beyond just academics. It feels like it could be a very popular book amongst people who just, you know, a popular history, not an academic one.
Yeah, and that's how I wrote it. There's a kind of sweet spot where, you know, there needs to be proper research for the credibility of the story, but it tries to wear the research and the learning lightly. And I wrote it for Shakespeare enthusiasts, not for fellow academics. And Arden understood that very well. And it's reaching people, you know, outside the university world, who are really interested in Shakespeare and find the story as intriguing as we do. So I'm doing my bit for public humanities. Professors outside the ivory tower.
I love it. And there should be much more of that. That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Richard Shook's book, Shakespeare's House, A Window Onto His Life and Legacy, is happily available wherever books are sold. Send us your dual focus via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. You can follow me on Twitter, which I refuse to call X unless I can pronounce it 10, @AustinTichner, or on Instagram and Threads @the.shakespeareans. You can also follow Richard Shook on Instagram @SE1_Richard. Thanks, as always, to Master Builder Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Wendy Sander. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Peter Holland, the former director of the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon and the McNeil Family Chair in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 905 2715ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.